Welcome to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where national experts bring you facts and answers. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev, an emergency and addiction doctor who has served at the White House and practiced on the front lines. Right here on High Truths, you will learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. High Truths is more than a podcast. It's a movement to unite physical, mental, and addiction health. It brings innovations to connect public health, public safety, and prevention. Our discussions inspire people to implement programs that save lives. To grow this community of information and action, I hope you give us a 5-star review. Come visit me on hightruths.com. Today's episode is sponsored by Drug Free America Foundation, tackling the pervasive issue of substance use and its far-reaching impacts on individuals, families, and community. Drug Free America is supporting ISAC, the International Academy on the Science and Impact of Cannabis, doctors and scientists educating on the harms of marijuana. Hello again, High Truth listeners. Get ready for a supportive conversation. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev. Supportive, as in supporting the family and relatives of a person with addiction. Addiction is a family disease. We often focus on the individual, but the spouse, parents, siblings, children, an entire family circle is affected by someone with addiction. Often it's the relative, not the person with addiction, who is first to identify a problem. One of the symptoms of many addictions is anagnosia. Anagnosia is the medical word for the lack of ability to perceive one's own condition. We see this with dementia. The individual does not realize that he or she is impaired. And we also see this with addiction. The individual using drugs believes they are fine, but people around know they are not. I recall treating a patient that was a nurse. Her case was striking because she worked in a busy unit treating others and yet ended up in the emergency department clearly impaired, physically tweaking from drugs. She had no perception of her condition, yet it was very visible to anyone passing by. Supporting families of someone with addiction is important. The loved one wants to help, doesn't know how, feels powerless, guilty, anxious, depressed, and more. One fellowship known for supporting families is Al-Anon. Al-Anon was founded in 1951, 16 years after Alcoholic Anonymous was established in 1935, and follows a similar 12-step structure. A study of over 10,000 participants who attended AA or 12-step facilitated meetings shows that such meetings are more effective than CBT therapy for increasing abstinence. The purpose of Al-Anon is not an intervention or treatment of the person with alcoholism, but to support the family and friends. Al-Anon has a world base, districts, and individual small groups. Following this trend, Nar-Anon was established in 1968. NA, Narcotics Anonymous, was for people with narcotic disorder and addiction, and Nar-Anon for people whose lives were affected by someone else's drug addiction. And with today's commercialization of high-potency THC, we have a growing number of people with addiction to marijuana or cannabis use disorder. MA, Marijuana Anonymous, is similar to AA, and Mar-Anon is similar to Al-Anon. To learn more about Mar-Anon, I reached out to Bart. Bart, like many people, thought marijuana is natural, a medicine, and not a big deal. It's just pot. Years later, he realized it's a big deal, very big deal. Bart managed his own cannabis use disorder and suffered along his son's addiction as well. To learn more about Bart and Mar-Anon, check out the High Truth show notes. I recorded this conversation with Bart on April 25th, 2025. Bart, welcome to High Truths.
Thank you, Ronit. Really, really, really glad to be here.
Yeah, it is. We get to reconnect. We've had several connections in the past, and we could maybe share that with the audience. But I thought we'd start with you sharing your experience with marijuana, and then we'll talk about your son Kevin's journey and how that was different.
Okay, well, yeah, so it was fun at first. I started smoking joints in the 1970s. I was in my early 20s, and I was going to San Francisco State, and I met this guy named Dennis Perrone, who was, I guess, kind of the father of the legalization of medical marijuana. And he had a pot supermarket in his house in San Francisco, and a student organization that I was co-founder and president of, invited him to speak at the student union. He gave us a whole bunch of joints to pass out in front of the student union for free. We had about 100 people there, and I even bought some marijuana from him back then. I thought it was harmless and just a, you know, just a fun drug.
Were you a hippie?
You know, I had an afro at the time, but I wouldn't call myself a hippie. I thought that, you know, again, it was no big deal. And, you know, why is it illegal? You know, and all that kind of stuff. So
were you an activist?
Yeah, I was an activist for, I'd say, the legalization and the promotion of marijuana.
Wow. And the club that you were head of and founder, what was that?
It was the Libertarian Alliance.
Interesting.
Yeah, in San Francisco State. So, and so what happened was we even grew a plant in our apartment in Crown Colony down there in Daly City, and harvested it and had a big harvest party. And I guess one of the funniest times I can remember was when the Allman Brothers were playing, turned up the music really loud. We had probably 50 people in a two-bedroom apartment. And it was pretty wild and crazy. And they said, everybody grab a light switch. So everybody's grabbing a light switch. And the lights are going on and off, having a light show during the song. And I kept hearing this, rah, 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 rah. I was like, well, where's that coming from? And I followed the sound. It was in the kitchen. And there was a girl. She was very stoned. She's looking at the kitchen light on the ceiling, and she thought that she was turning that on and off, but there was no correlation with what she was doing and what the light was doing. She had the garbage disposal switch. And so that was probably the funniest thing I can remember back in those days when, you know, again, I thought it was a harmless drug.
Did you ever get arrested for using, get in trouble?
No, it was in San Francisco, so... I think, I know Dennis Perone got arrested quite a few times because he sold it right out of his house, and he made he didn't hide it at all. But I didn't, I never sold it. I just bought it. And so then, what happened was I, actually got addicted to it, and I'd never heard of cannabis use disorder, but that's definitely what I had. And so I had low motivation, a lot of stinking thinking, not thinking clearly. And my personality changed from being, you know, happy-go-lucky, positive, and that type of thing, to a lot of times being short-tempered and negative, you know, feeling that I was a victim a lot of the times and that type of stuff. So my girlfriend at the time, she talked to me about my personality changes and my motivation, lack of motivation. And so I did my best to cut back. And so I probably started drinking more than, smoking pot, but I still did both. And sometimes I'd overdo it with both alcohol and the marijuana. And so then when my girlfriend and I got married, then I stopped doing the marijuana and just basically transferred over to alcohol. And I never got a DUI, but I definitely overdrank sometimes. And I definitely, unfortunately, drunk sometimes. I just never got caught. But that was I just basically transferred my addiction from the marijuana to the alcohol. And so then fast forward many years, Kevin, was our youngest son, and he actually came to us. He was 15 years old, and he said, "You know, I'm worried about myself. I'm depressed. Feel depressed." And I started smoking marijuana. He said that at 15.
And what did you think? I mean, did you think, "Well, it's no big deal. I did it too."
Yeah, you know, I kind of thought that, but then at first, that was my initial reaction. Because again, I just believed everything I'd been hearing about it being no big deal and all that. But then because he came to us and he had been showing signs of just being really quiet, I just thought, you know, that it was a stage he was going through. And my wife thought the same thing. But when he came to us, we thought, okay, no, this is serious. Let's get him into counseling and let's take this seriously. And so that's what we did.
Tell me about Kevin. What kind of kid was
he? So Kevin was very intelligent. He always scored, you know, like 99 percentile on the testing in school. He was in GATE. He was a very good musician, playing the piano. And but he was quiet. He was a lot quieter than our other son, who was kind of the opposite. And so he was also very sensitive. And a lot of times he just again didn't communicate his feelings to us. And so, he had a really funny sense of humor. And, he was just a great kid all around.
That's great. And what happened? You did all the right things. He came at an early age, 15, saying, I need help. And you got him to, you took it seriously.
So what happened is we went to an educational consultant and they gave him a bunch of testing and they confirmed, yes, he's depressed. And he also is a follower. So he should not be in the same environment. Because, with his friends and stuff who are using marijuana too. And so he should go to, they recommend a wilderness program. So because otherwise he'd just stay and it'd be really hard for him to say no because he was such a follower. That's what they recommended, long story short. And so.
Interesting. I don't know. I think that's what, I may be mistaken, but Bobby Kennedy, our Health and Human Secretary, had an addiction, and he said he got help from going to those wilderness programs or farms.
Right, yeah. So in fact, it's funny to say that. We just heard him speak yesterday at the RX Summit, really amazing talk that he gave. But so he went to this wilderness program in Utah. He was there for 7 weeks, and it seemed to really benefit him. We went up to see him the last day and bring him home for a little bit. And then he went from there to a therapeutic boarding school in Phoenix, Arizona, and seemed to really thrive and do really well there at this therapeutic boarding high school. And so that's basically what happened. So then what happened is he convinced us to the following year to go to a co-ed school, all boys school, a co-ed school in Virginia that was not therapeutic, but had a really good reputation. And he wanted to go there because a friend that he met at the boarding school was transferring and had transferred and just said a lot of great things about the school in Virginia. So we went and checked it out with Kevin, and he ended up going there. And joining the cross country team. And unfortunately, again, at first he was doing really well. He was doing, I think he was third in his class as far as achievements and all of that. And then with the cross country team, he became friends with this guy who lived there in the town. And they would run to his friend's house, and we found out later, and smoke marijuana.
And his addiction recurred.
Exactly. Yeah. So then from there, the school, he started going down as far as his performance. The school contacted us and said that he really should probably come home and, work on, that addiction that he has to marijuana and get into recovery. And then he's totally welcome back. So he came home and we had a zero tolerance, policy with it. And we also got him, again, help through counseling and, just being really supportive and all. And then what happened is on his 18th birthday, we found a bud of marijuana in his pocket. And we said, you have to leave. And so that was one of the hardest things we've ever had to do. But it was the day he turned 18.
And then what happened to him?
Then he, I think, did couch surfing with friends and all that. And I think he was out on the streets a little bit here and there. And so then my wife actually ran into him at a park, and it was really, really sad. He had some skin lesions on him, and it was just, yeah, just really tragic. So, yeah, he promised that he would get back into recovery. So we brought him back into the house, and again, just tried to support him as much as we could. You know, that whole thing about not enabling, not trying not to be codependent. We were both in Al-Anon, and he was going to like Alcoholics Anonymous meetings and some Marijuana Anonymous meetings, and he had a sponsor. So it seemed like things were going pretty well. And then he ended up going back out and doing it. Basically, the cycle kept on kind of going back and forth over the years.
Relapsing. That's why they call it a relapsing disease.
Exactly. And so then what happened is he had this therapist that both my wife and I, and he just thought was fantastic. It became highly recommended. And he started making some really positive changes, and again, in recovery. And then Kevin came to us after seeing him for about a year, I believe it was. And he said that he had done some very inappropriate things with Kevin. And so when we confirmed that, we hired a lawyer and sued him. And, you know, we thought, okay, this is going to be good because we're going to get, we spent crazy amounts of money on this therapist because we actually all saw him at different times, saw him together as a family. And we just thought, you know, this is going great. So we spent lots and lots of money. And so we thought, oh, this is going to be good. We're going to get our money back. I mean, it's terrible what happened, but we'll get our money back. And
he was abused by his therapist.
Yeah, he was abused by his therapist. Yeah. It was terrible. So then what happened was Kevin got $100,000. And so at 21 years old, he got $100,000. And at first he was like, you know, Dad, you know, won't you help me, you know, manage the money because I have a little experience with that. And so he was being really responsible. He didn't even touch it. We put it in safe investments and all that. And then after about 5 months, he decided to take it and take off. And so he took off and spent a ton of it, as far as we know, on marijuana. And just anyway, just you know, living in chaos basically, and until the money ran out. And he ended up coming back to us broke. We saw him at a park, you know, what happened is we just said, well, the only way we can help is if you, you know, agree to go to rehab. And so he did. And so he ended up going to the Menninger Clinic in Houston, Texas, extremely expensive. But again, he was making some really good progress. What happened was eventually he went to the step down program. Then I think the main problem with that was the step down was too far down. It would have been nice if there's something in between, you know, the step down from where he was, where he was, you know, had started in that program. And again, after he got out, he went back to using again. And so then it's just this basically cycle just kept on going. And he eventually died by suicide on August 14th, 2018. And his last articulate words to me were, cannabis has ruined my life.
And it did.
It did, yeah. And because every time we saw him using, he got worse, not better, from any kind of, you know, depression he had, anxiety and all that.
You think historically too, time frame, probably the potency that he was using each time was more and more and more.
Exactly. Yeah. He built up a tolerance, and over the, you know, over time, and needed more and more to get to that same level of intoxication. And, so what happened too was that, he just, kept calling it his medicine, and it made him worse, not better.
Yeah. You know, I think that that's how we met, you and I, Bart, is I met the various parent victims. You know, when I started my career into addiction, I never thought I'd get here, but it was because I was a drug supplier of opiates, and I met all these parents who were upset that their kids were getting addicted to prescription. And today, there's a whole group of very activist parents that are angry about, you know, the fentanyl crisis and their kids being poisoned. And I don't think, you know, many Americans realize that there is a growing number of parents like you whose children have been, you know, victims of marijuana poisoning. And I think that's how we met, because we were trying to pass a bill in California to require labeling. Labels like we have for tobacco, like we have for alcohol, like you have on your mattresses, you know, and on your movie screens. Like everybody has labels. We wanted the same type of science, evidence-based science, on marijuana products, so people will make informed decisions in using and understand the risks, you know. And we got, and you were the one to testify in Sacramento. Want to tell us about that experience?
Right. So you testified, it's again, just common sense legislation, and my wife did too. And they looked at us like we had three heads. Like, what are you talking about? Why would you ever, you know, need to do that? And it's just this continual belief, like I had when I was young, that it's just weed. It's just marijuana. It's no big deal. And now, of course, there's so much money in it that they want to say that. The politicians and many people in power want to say that because they get a lot of money from the industry and from the lobbyists. But it's just so obvious to anyone who knows about how strong it is these days, and the cannabis-induced psychosis, which my son kept having, that led to his suicide, and the hundreds and getting close to, I think, 1,000 people. Either I read their stories or talked to them on the phone or on Zoom that have been affected by this. And I know that, you know, I hope it's shorter than longer or sooner than longer. But I know someday we're going to look back on it and we're going to say, wow, the tobacco industry fooled us way back when, and they fooled us again with cannabis.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's guaranteed. That's been the history repeating itself. We don't always learn from history.
Exactly.
Sadly, but yeah, you and I both testified. You as a parent with, you know, Kevin's amazing tragic story, and you know, the medical aspects of what we're seeing in the emergency department, and they still and the governor also shut us down, which was sad. But it didn't stop you, because you are still, you know, making a blessing of Kevin's memory, and you're now active with Marinon. And I did explain to the audience that it's Marijuana Anonymous, but we want to learn a little bit more about that. Like, I don't think a lot of people know that it exists, but why do we need Marijuana Anonymous? You said that you and Kevin went to Alcoholic Anonymous, and there's Narcotics Anonymous, and then there's Anon. So there's Al-Anon, you know, Naranon, right. And now you have Marinon. Why do we need a separate? Why does each drug need its separate little thing?
Right. That's a really good question. So it gets confusing when I try to explain it to people. And it's just like, you know, sometimes I go on and on and on and on. Yeah. And so what it is I think the best way to explain it is Dr. Bob and Bill W. are known for starting Alcoholics Anonymous back in 1935, and that came from another group of people, and they weren't the only ones doing it, but I mean, they're the two main people that get the credit for starting the 12-step program, the first one called Alcoholics Anonymous, AA. Well, now there's over 100 12-step programs, and they're specific for gambling addiction, narcotics addiction, and even marijuana addiction, so cannabis use disorder. So in the 1980s, a group of people who were addicted to marijuana and in recovery from cannabis use disorder started Marijuana Anonymous. At first, there were three groups, and they got together and formed Marijuana Anonymous. So anyway, but before that, to add more confusion to it, in the 1950s, a bunch of women got together who were married to these guys who were going to Alcoholics Anonymous, and decided that they needed support also. So, you know, a lot of times their husbands were, again, it was mostly men, and they're almost all married, but you know, the men were going to these meetings, spending lots of time with their AA friends, and lots of times in meetings, and they started feeling, oh, what about us? You know, and we have challenges too, living with someone who is in recovery from alcoholism or relapses, et cetera, et cetera. So they started something called Al-Anon. Again, it's a 12-step program, and it's for support for people who have loved ones who are have either active addiction to and actively using alcohol or in recovery from. Okay, so then in the 1990s, a small group of people started Maranon. And so Maranon is just like Al-Anon, but for marijuana instead of alcohol. And the reason that they started that, and I think it's separate from these other Anons, say Al-Anon, is because so often they would go to somebody and say, you know, my son or my husband's addicted to marijuana, you know, blah, blah, blah. And the person would say something like, oh, no, alcohol is worse. That's just, you know, pot, you know, that's not addictive. It grows out of the ground. It's natural, you know. So they didn't get the support they needed. And so they started Maranon.
Did that happen to you when you were?
Oh, yeah. A lot of when Kevin was going through.
You were dismissed. Like, what are you here in this group for? That's like.
Exactly. Other friends we had that were parents were like, oh, that's just, you know, a stage he's going through. It's not a big deal. And they said the same thing. You know, it's just pot. And so so then what happened was they started this organization, again, 12-step. It's basically Al-Anon, but instead of alcohol, it's marijuana. So what happened was that they started a Facebook page, a couple of Facebook groups, a long email chain. And when I found it in 2020, they had about 150 members, and they're really helping each other out and stuff like that. However, there weren't enough people in a certain area to have in-person meetings, or that either knew about Maranon or had the courage to go to a meeting. So then when I found it in 2020, October of 2020, I emailed, I said, oh, where are the meetings? And the one person keeping the website going, her name was Brooke, she was hoping someone was going to come along and say, okay, yeah, let me help you, you know? And everybody else had kind of, I think, got burnt out. And so Brooke, you know, kept on going. She said, well, there's no meetings. And I said, well, can I start Zoom meetings? And she goes, oh, that'd be great. Because she knew I told her I had a lot of experience with Al-Anon. Again, same format as Al-Anon. The meeting guide was on the website. And so I started these Zoom meetings, and the thing just explodes. And we get people from all over the country, start getting people from England, Australia, Canada, Mexico. And now we have over 2,500 members. There were no regular meetings until October of 2020. And I actually got a lot of help too to do all this. So it definitely I just kind of helped out. Brooke kept the thing going. I came along, but again, it's been a big team effort.
That's great. So, is this a 12-step format meeting for family members?
It's for loved ones. So it could even be like a brother or a sister of someone who's, has cannabis use disorder, but it's usually parents or a partner, so, you know, husband or wife. Yeah. And anyone who has a loved one who has, and it could be in recovery too. They could be going to Marijuana Anonymous. You know, their loved one can be in recovery, or they're going to some other program or seeing a therapist. And so they're in recovery from it, or they're actually an active user of it.
So take us through a meeting. What's it like? I click on my Zoom and what should
I? Yeah, well, number one, anyone can come to a meeting. They're open meetings. And just let us know.
I can join even though I don't have a problem or a family member. I just
couldn't. Yeah, exactly. If you just want to, like, we've had therapists come and check this out. Okay. And a lot of therapists actually recommend Marilyn. And so, but anyone can come to a meeting. They're called, they're basically open meetings. But please, before you do, you know, come a little bit early. You know, we start on the hour, and depending on your time zone. And I can tell you how to get to a meeting, but as far as the whatever technically, but before I talk about that, just know that you can come. You're welcome. However, come to a few minutes early. Just tell us your first name and why you're there, and then we ask you probably not to share unless you have a loved one that's having a problem or had a problem with marijuana. And then after the meeting's over, the 1 hour meeting's over, again, if you want to share a little bit, that's fine, about why you went to the meeting, maybe even what you thought of the meeting. But during the 1 hour, we hold that time for the person that, again, has the loved one that's having the issue.
So what happens during that hour?
So what we do is we talk about the ground rules. There's no... And this is the same for every 12-step meeting, again, like Alcoholics Anonymous or Al-Anon. So there, we talk about crosstalk. There's no crosstalk, meaning that if I say, my loved one, we call them qualifiers sometimes, I'll just say my loved one, came home stoned, and I talked to him about it, and he started yelling at me. Then crosstalk would be someone else saying, oh, Bart, you should have done this, you should have done that. So try not to shit on people, okay? So no crosstalk as far as, just telling the person what to do or directly responding to that person's share. And that way the person feels safer, that people aren't going to, criticize them or, make them feel uncomfortable. So then the next person who wants to share, and the sharing is totally optional. Some people share, some people don't. You don't have to be on camera, so you can either have your camera off or on. And then we also ask for your mic to be off when you're not sharing. We ask you to be conscious of the time. Sometimes we have time limits, and just because we want to have enough time for everybody who wants to share, something going on too long.
How many people come? Or is there a size limit?
I'd say we average about 10 people a meeting for our meetings. And on Saturdays, we have anywhere from usually 25 to 30 on Saturday mornings. And that's our largest meeting. And it's, give me an example. The Saturday morning meeting starts at 7 o'clock Pacific time. So then, of course, that's 10 o'clock Eastern time. And so you just have to calculate the time or, look at the website. But that's one mistake some people make, because the first time you'll see when you go to the meetings section of our website is you'll see Central Time. So you just have to calculate it for where you live. And then, so let's see what else. The one meeting though that's not open is on Thursdays, and that is for partners, spouses, partners. So, I mean, if you are, so that meeting's not open. So you definitely have to get permission to go to that meeting if you have a spouse that is, or a partner that's in recovery.
So how many meetings are you running?
So we have 11 approximately 11 meetings a week. We have two meetings a month in Albany, California, next to Berkeley. In person, we have two meetings a month in Newport Beach in person, and so we're starting to get in-person meetings also.
Wow. And what do people say about their experience? Is it, do you still, in Alcoholics and Anonymous and Al-Anon, they say don't judge it by your first meeting. You may need to go to different meetings or something if you didn't click. Is that the same
kind? I'm so glad you said that. So my wife and I went to our first Al-Anon meeting about 21 years ago. And the therapist suggested it. And so when we did that, it was about, let's see, two other people there. So it was four of us all together. And it was, of course, in person before Zoom. And it was kind of a dark room. And afterwards, my wife and I were walking back to the car, just saying, I guess Al-Anon isn't for us. And they either didn't say check out like different meetings, or we didn't hear it, because that's what you should say. You should, you know, at least communicate to try out different meetings and see which meetings fit you the best, because every meeting has a different personality. It just all depends on, you know, who attends the meeting, who shows up, who's leading the meeting, that type of thing. So I totally agree with you that you should definitely keep coming back. At least I'd go to probably until you find a meeting that fits you and you feel really like it's a good fit. I would probably check out like five or six different meetings, and then it takes a while to figure out that you know, it's really going to help you. But I think actually, if you go to any meeting, you'll feel support, because the thing we hear more often than anything from a newcomer is, finally, I found a group of people who don't say it's just pot or it's just weed, and I feel supported and I feel understood.
Yeah. What about people who are atheists? They don't believe in God. They don't want the 12 step. I know for alcohol and drugs, they have specific non 12 step programs that are help. Is this different, or is it says the same? If you wouldn't like Alcoholics Anonymous for those reasons, would this be the same?
Well, actually, it's interesting. There's a pamphlet that Alcoholics Anonymous has, and it's AA for atheists. So you can be an atheist, you can be agnostic, and you can still get a lot out of the 12-step meetings.
But do you, as an individual, need to go through the 12 steps?
You don't need to do anything. All this stuff is suggested, okay? So that's another thing we like, people that I know in 12-step programs. That's one of the main things we like about the 12-step programs. It doesn't say you must do this, you must do that, and you have to do it this way, you have to do it that way, you have to believe in God. So you can just go, and if it helps you, it helps you. We don't have to worry about, in fact, a lot of us say, you know, it works. We're not exactly sure how it works, but it works.
And for Maranon, right? Okay. For the people who are using, they at one point in the steps, they get a sponsor, right? For the families who are getting the support, is that the same thing? You get somebody who supports you, or no? That's not.
Yeah. I mean, that's the model. Okay.
Yeah. So there's a model for the families too.
Right, is to get a sponsor who you can relate to. Let's say it's a similar situation as you. Let's say, as far as, let's say, like for me, you know, looking to get a sponsor that is someone whose, you know, son is using, or, you know, child is using, or, you know, so somewhat similar, and someone, of course, you feel a connection with. So that's the way to go about it. Just basically ask them, you know, number one, have you started working the steps? And if they say yes, you know, you can just say, I'm new, I'm looking for a sponsor, and you know, what step are they on, if you don't mind me asking? And if they say, you know, I'm on step four, so usually what we suggest, again, it's just a suggestion, if they finish step three, and they want to be your sponsor, then we think it's a good idea to be a sponsor, because it helps them too. Helps both the sponsor and the sponsee. And but there's some people that never get a sponsor. And there's some people that get a sponsor, and then the sponsor moves, or, you know, unfortunately passes away or whatever. And you know, then they don't get a sponsor maybe for a year or two, but they still go to meetings, because the meetings you know, are just really supportive. And a lot of times you'll hear your story from someone else in the meetings. And yeah. So again, there's no, you know, I guess the model or the ideal way, ideal is probably not the best way to say it, but we find that most people find that having a sponsor and working the steps helps.
Yeah. And I think that's science-based too. They've done studies and people have gone to meetings and not gone to meetings. And the thing that supports long-term recovery is continuing meetings. That's a key.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I totally agree. And
I think that was even on my addiction medicine boards.
Oh, no, that's great. And because there's people that, you know, doctors and therapists and stuff that don't really know much about 12-step programs, have never visited an open 12-step meeting. So it's great that you know about them. And it would be nice, you know, if more people knew.
Yeah. I attended, but I have to come to one of your meetings.
And that'd be great. We'd love it. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, there's separate, you have groups. I was really intrigued that you have groups for cannabis hyperemesis syndrome and cannabis-induced psychosis, what Kevin had, and there are thousands of people who join these Facebook groups. Can you tell us a little
bit? Well, yeah, it's just unbelievable. So again, not me, but this woman started, maybe, I don't know if she started by herself, but anyway, it's a group called the CHS Recovery Facebook group. So it's a private group. You have to answer a few questions and join. And you could just be someone who's interested in cannabinoid hyperemesis syndrome, which you came up with that term, scromining, isn't that right?
Yeah.
Right.
That's my claim to famous is making it famous. Yeah.
Right. So so scromining, which is CHS. Anyway, there's over 30,000 members now, and most of them either had CHS or have CHS, and it's an extremely supportive group. Again, it's called the CHS Facebook Recovery Group.
I told that to a patient once, you know, to check out this group. She was in the emergency department with you know, acute pain and vomiting. And I had told her, you know, it's a common problem, and did my whole doctor spiel. But I suggested that she check out the group, and she said she did. And she said sometimes people suggested for her to continue using or to switch to edibles instead of smoke products, or giving, I don't know, weird medical advice that's.
Do you know how long ago that was?
Maybe 2 years.
Okay. Yeah, I haven't read that lately, and I don't visit it every day. But yeah. I think things have gotten better.
Yeah.
As far as that goes, I think the moderators, because it got, I think, overwhelming, as you know, let's say hundreds of people joined, you know, every week, and so for the administrators, it got overwhelming. So I think some of those things slipped through, most of the stuff I read is helpful on there. And people say, you know, most thing I read also is you need to stop all cannabis products. Because even I thought I knew more than I did. And I wrote, I said, just stop the THC. And right away, I think it was an administrator sent to me, said, actually, once you have CHS, you have to stop all cannabis products, even CBD.
Interesting. And oh, it's interesting. Yeah, I don't, I am, whatever, I'm not on Facebook, but if I had to give a recommendation for the group, it would be get a copy of your abdominal CT scan and share it. Don't hide it. So you don't end up getting 10 CAT scans that with all that radiation will get you cancer later on in life. And to be honest with your doctor, and because a lot of times patients are ashamed that this is happening to them, and they're like, I don't know. And then I look at the records, and it's like, you've been here, you've had endoscopy, you have CAT scans. It's like, just say that what it is so we can get you treatment faster.
Yeah, no, I think that's great. And you can join. Like I say, I've never had it, but CHS, but I joined because I'm interested in the subject. And you could join. And again, you answer three questions. And you could just say, you know, from your experience, you know, as a doctor, basically what you just said, you know.
And I
think they would approve that post.
I'm just, that's one social media I can.
Okay. Yeah, no problem. But anyway, then there's another one, and it's called the CHS Caretakers Group. It has over 4,000 people. And again, those are parents.
CHS for cannabis hyperemesis syndrome caretakers?
Correct.
Or psychosis?
For CHS. So it's basically the, let's say, parents of someone who has CHS.
CHS or cannabis use disorder or
CHS.
Wow.
Yeah. So there's a caretakers group. It's called the CHS Caretakers Facebook group. And it has over 4,000 people. And again, those are parents or spouses of someone who's got CHS or, again, or who had CHS.
Yeah. There are people who died of it. I talked to a mom whose son died after, you know, an episode of vomiting and cannabis hyperemesis syndrome. So it has to be taken seriously. I can imagine how scary it is.
Oh, terrible.
People. I mean, you said that there's another group for cannabis-induced psychosis. How big is that group?
Well, so through Johnny's Ambassadors, there's a group. Now, I think it's like family members of, or maybe people who have recovered from. It could even be maybe people who, you know, have had cannabis-induced psychosis. And the one I can think of is through Johnny's Ambassadors on Facebook. And I think there's over, I think there's like 1,500 people and growing. And then there's, you know, Every Brain Matters, a nonprofit that's got a lot of followers and that educates on, you know, all the harm that cannabis can cause, especially for the developing brain until you're about 25, but even after that. And also what's nice about Every Brain Matters is they have two support meetings every week on Wednesday night and on Saturday mornings. And it's called Climbers, like climbing a mountain. And it's on Every Brain Matters. If you go to the meetings section of the website, go down to Wednesday or Saturday. And it's actually led by a professional therapist. And so difference about those meetings compared to Marinon is there is healthy crosstalk. So and because you have a facilitator, professional facilitator. So it's mostly parents, but I would actually recommend anyone who's got a loved one who has this issue, check out one of those meetings too. It's like Every Brain Matters, the meetings section. And then on Wednesdays and Saturdays, and it's called Climbers. I don't recommend that from, as a representative of Marinon, because it's not exactly 12 steps, but I know it's helped me, my wife, and many others.
And we did a podcast with Aubrey with Every Brain Matters, so we can reference that as well for anybody who's listening. Bart, you've been you know, spending many years and many hours on this, and obviously meeting people. What have you learned since you started this from these meetings and your journey? And
yeah, well, what I've learned is it helps me to try to honor my son the best I can by volunteering my time and doing what I can to try to help others so that they don't have to go down the path that my son did, or down the path that my wife and I, you know, our family did. If you can catch it earlier, the earlier the better. And again, how not to enable, how not to be codependent, but to be loving, and how to take care of yourself. I've learned a lot about self-care. It's like, you know, putting your own oxygen mask on first on the airplane.
Yeah.
A lot of times I wasn't taking care of myself during all the chaos with my son, and I thought, oh, I'm just gonna, you know, be a martyr, and, you know, think of that out loud. But now that I look back on it, it was like I was being a martyr. And if I'm going to go down the tubes and, you know, my life's going to be ruined, at least I can try to save my son. But actually, the opposite is true, is that the more I take care of myself and the healthier I am, the stronger I am there and healthier I am to be there for my loved one.
Other people. That's important. And but the giving is also key, because being depressed is very selfish.
Exactly.
And if I when I find myself in that way, the thing I tell myself, okay, do something for someone else.
Exactly.
Get yourself out of that.
Yeah, and another thing for me, especially being in recovery myself, I heard a really great one, I think about a week ago. My ego is not my amigo. So my ego definitely was not my amigo. Because I was either like a legend in my own mind or a total loser. So now I try to be, you know, I try to right size myself. So, you know, so I'm not a total loser and I'm not a legend in my own mind. I just try to be the best person I can and do the next right thing.
I love it. My ego is not my amigo. Love it. So any, I think, well, other resources I think we'll give people is the Isaac resource, the International Academy on Science and Impact of Cannabis. If people want to know more about like data questions, these are groups of physicians and scientists who want to educate people on that.
I love Isaac. I love you guys.
I'm part of that group. And Bart, it seems like you went full circle in your life, starting out being an activist for marijuana and now being an activist in helping people prevent use and to get treatment and help if there is a problem.
Yeah, it's been quite a journey. Of course, I wish I knew then what I know now, but you know, now it's better than never.
So, what would you tell your old Bart, young Bart? What would you say? What would old Bart say, young Bart?
Exactly. I'd say drug is a drug. THC is a drug, and it changes the way you feel in an unhealthy way. It might feel healthy and good at first, but after a while, it brings you down. And that's, again, not to say that there's not people that can, you know, of course, drink casually, use cannabis casually, this and that. But for definitely young people below the age of 25 or so, with a developing brain, it's so easy to get addicted to, cannabis, especially nowadays with the high THC marijuana. And the other thing, right now anyway, after being at this conference that I was at,
the National RX Conference.
Yeah, the RX
Summit.
Yeah. So let's be on the same team. Instead of someone coming up to me and say alcohol is worse, or of course fentanyl is worse, or this is worse, or that's worse. Well, why don't we join the same team and give young people, especially, the same message that any drug to change the way you feel and become intoxicated is unhealthy. That way, I think we'll be more effective instead of saying, oh, no, you know, it's okay to do, you know, marijuana, cannabis, it's okay to do alcohol, it's okay, especially again for young people. Let's
protect your brain.
Right. Protect your brain and let's be on the same page instead of, oh, no, that's worse, that's better, that's not as big a deal. Because most people don't start out with fentanyl.
Yeah.
Most people don't start out with a whole bottle of whiskey. They start out with, you know, alcohol, marijuana, and nicotine. And so we need to, I think, be consistent with our messaging.
Yeah, well, that's beautiful. And right, so you bring a blessing to Kevin's memory. You've changed your activism and taken that and put that in wonderful places. And the other thing I really notice is that your wife has been with you through this whole journey and supports you. And I think that's beautiful.
Yeah, no, it's been great. And I definitely appreciate and love her very much. And I know that Al-Anon, it really helped us a lot because, we go to the meetings together at least once a week. And I even go to an Al-Anon meeting once a week now. So anybody who, goes to Maranon, we also promote open marijuana anonymous meetings, which there's about 500 a week. A lot of them are on Zoom. So that way they get an idea of what it's like to be in recovery from, you know, a marijuana addiction. And then we also say, Al-Anon can help too. Every once in a while at Al-Anon, you might get someone saying, like I just said, you know, alcohol is worse, that type of thing. Yeah. But most of the time you get a lot of support from Al-Anon also.
Yeah. And if we look at people who died by suicide under the age of 25, a lot more THC than alcohol. But like you said, we're on the same team. It doesn't matter. I don't want any of those diseases, right?
Exactly.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much for joining us, Bart, and good luck in continuing your journey in this.
Well, thanks so much, Cabroni, for having me. We appreciate it. Take care.
Thank you for listening to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where you learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs. This week's episode would not be possible without the generous support of our sponsor. A sincere and warm thank you to Drug Free America Foundation. Visit DFAF.org. And ISAC, the International Academy on the Science and Impact of Cannabis. That's IASIC1.org. High Truths producer is Dave Rivas from Davey Boy Productions. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev. We hope we brought your day a little bit more High Truths.